President Obama wraps up his trip to Latin America.
What's on the line economically?
Marketplace Midday Update is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
From APM, American Public Media in Los Angeles, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm Steve Chiotakis. Thanks for checking out the podcast from Marketplace.org. It's Tuesday, the 22nd of March.
Coming up, Libya's leader is sitting on a pot of gold, and that's making sanctions ineffective. Also, what's in a name? Well, everything when you're robbing a bank.
All that ahead on the Marketplace Midday Update.
Looking for a good read? Visit the Big Book blog at Marketplace.org. Listen to author interviews and read excerpts from the Marketplace bookshelf. Online at Marketplace.org/the Big Book.
President Obama travels to El Salvador today as he continues his trip to Latin America. On the agenda for the president, free trade agreements with a couple of countries that have been sidelined for a long time. Here's Marketplace's David Gura.
Deals with Colombia and Panama have been in the works for almost 5 years.
This is unfinished business that should have been taken care of a long time ago.
That's Jeffrey Schott, a fellow with the Peterson Institute for International Economics. Another free trade agreement with Korea also needs congressional approval. All three pacts would reduce taxes on exports, including agricultural products, and the U.S. would get more opportunities to bid on lucrative Korean government contracts. President Obama may be a supporter, but some Democrats are concerned about working conditions in Colombia and Panama. Schott says the administration and Congress are working on that issue.
They seem to be making a lot of progress on, in particular, labor-oriented provisions.
Republicans want up or down votes on all three agreements as soon as possible. In Washington, I'm David Gura for Marketplace.
Now let's get some analysis on the president's trip to Latin America with Shannon O'Neill, a fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. She's with us from New York. Good morning.
Good morning.
So tell us what the U.S. wants to get out of this trip.
Well, Obama talked in his State of the Union speech about doubling exports in the next 5 years as a way out of the economic downturn in the United States,
right.
So export-led growth. And Latin America is really a place to do this. It's one of the regions least hit hard by the global economic downturn that we've seen, and many of these countries have picked up and are growing really rapidly in terms of GDP. It's also a place with an expanding, even an exploding middle class. So millions and millions of people in Latin America are coming out of poverty, and they're ready consumers, either for U.S. goods or for others.
Okay, so we want exports. What do Latin American countries want?
You know, Latin American countries, some want specific things. For instance, Brazil, the first stop on the president's trips, they want an end to exports or to tariffs on exports that they have, such as ethanol or orange juice or cotton. And other countries want opening up of U.S. markets. That's one issue. But more broadly, really what Latin American wants is a recognition on the world stage. And they want consultation from the United States and others as a true partner. And we're seeing more and more issues that require multinational responses and solutions. And Latin America wants a seat at the table there. So when you think of economic crisis or climate change,
right,
or even instability in the Middle East, these affect Latin America and their citizens, and they want to be at the table in multilateral bodies when the solutions are come up with or when people are actually discussing how to address these issues in a multilateral way.
Okay, Shannon O'Neill from the Council on Foreign Relations.
Well, that $39 billion T-Mobile AT&T deal was hailed on Wall Street, and not just because it's the latest sign of an improving economy. It's the sort of payday that big banks have been waiting for ever since the economy tanked 3 years ago. Here's Marketplace senior business correspondent Bob Moon.
A penny for your thoughts? How about $145 million? That's what AT&T and T-Mobile's parent Deutsche Telekom reportedly could be paying just for advice from a half dozen investment firms. They don't simply sign off on a deal.
It seems like a very quick culmination, but oftentimes this is a process that has been going on for a very long time.
Hyder Harris is a corporate matchmaker at Harris Williams. He says firms like his can play a key role in arranging financing and deciding if firms are a good fit. In this case, J.P. Morgan Chase apparently thinks so. It's not just advising AT&T. It's chipping in the biggest loan it's ever made, $20 billion. Vipal Monga writes for The Deal and thinks this could bode well for the whole economy.
J.P. Morgan was one of the first banks to start pulling out of the large leverage buyouts that sort of initiated the credit crunch. So for J.P. Morgan to be stepping in, and Jamie Dimon in particular, known as one of the more conservative leaders of any bank out there, suggests that there's a lot of comfort.
Not to mention a lot of money to be made on pent-up merger demand. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
The United Auto Workers Union starts a 3-day meeting in Detroit today, just months before its contracts expire. And don't think union leaders can't see the rebound in sales at the big three automakers. As Marketplace's Elisa Roth reports, they'd like their piece of that.
Brett Ward has spent the last 17 years working for Chrysler. Like other auto workers, he made big concessions when his company got into trouble in 2008. He points out carmakers push through a two-tiered wage system, which pays new employees a much lower hourly rate. And now he wants something back.
I don't feel that we need to be making the sacrifices as much as management needs to make the sacrifices.
Ford and GM both earned money last year. Chrysler expects to be profitable this year. All three have recently given workers bonuses. Tom Culkin is a management professor at MIT's business school. He says the big three have to share the new wealth with their workers.
They've got to find a way to increase pay slowly, but do so in the context of sharing the benefits of the profits that Ford and GM achieve.
GM and Chrysler workers can't strike under the terms of their company's government loans. And at this point, Culkin thinks it's unlikely Ford workers will strike either. I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace.
The prospect of power being restored in northern Japan has the market higher in Japan. The Nikkei was up today 4.5%.
Though we got word this morning that supplies of some seafood from Japan, including farmed scallops, could be cut off for a year or more because of the tsunami.
Tiffany & Company reported profit rose by nearly a third in the last 3 months of 2010. But the jeweler lowered its earnings forecast for the first quarter of this year because of the earthquake and the tsunami in Japan. Apparently 18% of company sales came from Japan last year.
And drugstore chain Walgreens said this morning that its profits rose almost 10% last quarter because it is now filling 20% of all U.S. prescriptions. That's the highest market share for the company ever.
And you can find more numbers in our numbers section at marketplace.org.
Get Marketplace's top headlines, podcasts, and special features delivered right to your inbox each day. Subscribe to the Midday Update newsletter at marketplace.org.
You're listening to the Midday Update for Tuesday, March 22nd. Hello, I'm Steve Chiotakis.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson. Now let's get to the global perspective. What's happening in business and economics at the intersection of the U.S. and the rest of the world? The head of the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission says no changes are needed in American nuclear policy for now, and that all reactors in this country are safe.
Well, in Japan, the operator of the Fukushima Daiichi plant, Tokyo Electric Power, or TEPCO, has been under the microscope a lot lately, and this isn't the first time. As we continue to cover the human and the economic toll in Japan, Marketplace Asia Bureau Chief Rob Schmitz is with us with the latest. Hey, Rob.
Hey, Steve. From a pretty shaky Tokyo, we just had another aftershock.
Ooh. Are you guys okay?
Yeah, we are. It shook for a long time, though. Pretty big one.
All right. Well, tell us a little bit about this company, TEPCO, Rob, and walk us through what happened at that plant.
Well, TEPCO is the fourth largest power company in the world. It's the biggest one in Japan, and it currently owns a third of the electricity market in Japan and runs three nuclear power plants. The Fukushima Daiichi plant that's now leaking radiation was its first nuclear plant, and that plant has six reactors. TEPCO's had problems with its other reactors before. A few years ago, it was forced to shut down another plant after an earthquake. At that time, TEPCO said the plant hadn't been designed to cope with such a large quake. It's also been caught falsifying nuclear safety data at least 200 times, and it's had a former president and board members step down because of those problems.
You know, Rob, is this going to change the mix of power reliance in Japan? Is the country going to shy away from nuclear?
Well, today I spoke to Hirotaka Yamauchi about this. He's an expert on Japan's nuclear power industry. At first, we talked about the politicians in Japan all the way up the chain to Prime Minister Naoto Kan, who've been criticizing TEPCO and saying something needs to change. But Yamauchi put this into perspective. So here he's saying that politicians may be angry and irritated, but they're just showing off. He can't imagine they'd actually change the policy toward nuclear power and go on an entirely different direction with Japan's energy mix. And it should be noted that Japan produces virtually no domestic fossil fuels, and it's always strived to be self-reliant when it comes to energy, so nuclear power was always a way to accomplish that. In fact, before this disaster, Prime Minister Kan vowed to increase the percentage of electricity nuclear power provides to Japan from a third, which is where it's currently at, to 70%. And Yamauchi says despite all the current problems at Fukushima, he doesn't think that goal is going to change.
All right. Marketplace's Rob Schmitz in Tokyo. Rob, thank you.
Thanks, Steve.
There's word this morning that the American-led military campaign has cut Libya's air defenses in half. Now, that military action follows economic sanctions and a freeze of assets associated with Muammar Gaddafi.
But a report in this morning's Financial Times says Gaddafi is sitting on so much gold that he and his army will be well-funded for some time, sanctions or not. Jack Farchi wrote the story for the Financial Times, and he's with us now from London. Good morning.
Morning.
So how much gold are we talking about here, and where did Gaddafi get it?
Well, the Libyan Central Bank holds about 144 tons of gold, according to the IMF. We suspect that actually it may hold a little bit more than that, and that's gold that they've had for quite a while. They bought it probably in the 80s, the 90s, the early part of this decade.
And the reason that this is such a big issue, obviously, is because Gaddafi can use this gold to pay the people who are fighting for him.
Exactly. And the gold price, as I'm sure you know, has shot up in the last decade.
Yeah.
So 144 or 150 tons of gold is worth something like $6.5-7 billion at the moment at current prices. The central bank is running quite short of hard currency because of the sanctions that have been put in place by the US and European countries. So if he can sell the gold, he's got a source of an awful lot of hard currency that could keep him going for a lot longer.
And you write in your story today that gold is a particularly attractive currency for criminals and dictators.
Well, indeed. It's a currency which is very hard to trace. And of course, unlike a dollar, or a euro, it doesn't rely on any government for its value. So it was very easy. If Gaddafi can get the gold out of the country, it can be melted down, and then it's impossible to know where it's come from.
Jack Farchi, reporter for the Financial Times, thanks so much.
Thank you.
German automaker Porsche says it would like to contribute to cleaning up the environment, Jeremy. The new 918 sports car. Have
yes.
you seen this yet?
No.
No, it comes out in a few years. It's going to reduce carbon emissions and empty the wallets of millionaires everywhere. Do you know how much it costs?
I don't even want to know if it's a Porsche.
$845,000.
Who can afford
nearly
these cars?
$1 million for this
wow.
car. Now, of course, that's just, you know, that's rudimentary right
yeah.
there. You know, it's not a big deal. It'll jet from 0 to 60 in 3.2 seconds.
Whoa.
Amazingly fast. But you're not going to jet long if you're in electric-only mode, Jeremy, because it has a range
yeah.
of 16 miles between plug-ins.
Well, maybe if you're just going from, you know, the pool house to the main mansion.
Maybe, yeah, you're just checking out the estate.
Just going
right?
around the estate.
You're listening to the Midday Update for Tuesday, March 22nd. Hello, I'm Steve Chiotakis.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson on Twitter, at Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm on Twitter as well, at Radio Chio. You can also give us your feedback by going to our website, marketplace.org, and clicking on the link that says Contact.
Well, Steve, do you know what this week is the anniversary of?
No.
It's the one-year anniversary of the Obama health care law. Can you believe it's been?
It's
it
been
feels
a
like
year.
It's been about 3 years
yeah,
since
it's
that
been
thing
like a decade. My gosh.
But even though most of the law's major provisions haven't kicked in yet, hospitals and insurance companies are getting ready. One way the law tries to cover more of the uninsured is by setting up insurance cooperatives or co-ops. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer visited a clinic in Maryland that's trying to morph into a co-op.
The clinic is in Howard County, Maryland, just outside Baltimore. Posters on the wall urge preventive dental care for babies and tell pregnant women with AIDS to get counseling. The clinic is part of a county program for the uninsured and working poor called Healthy Howard. Patients pay $50 to $85 a month for a set number of doctor visits.
All right. You have a seat here. Let me check you out.
Deborah Dunn is a physician's assistant with Healthy Howard. She's seen a lot of people who lost their jobs and insurance during the financial crisis.
Well, I'm seeing the patients having heart attacks and strokes as a result of not being able to afford their medications because of losing their insurances.
These are the types of people the co-op would serve. Healthy Howard and the co-op are the brainchild of the county health officer, Dr. Peter Bielenson. He's using Healthy Howard as a blueprint for his co-op, taking it statewide. Bielenson's co-op would charge a low monthly premium. Patients would see staff doctors who earn a straight salary instead of being paid by the procedure. Each patient would be given a personal health coach and action plan to kick bad habits. Sounds hokey, but Bielenson says it's paid off at Healthy Howard.
Poor eating habits, lack of exercise, smoking. So we work on all of those things, and that's helped to reduce costs.
And that's the idea behind the co-ops, inject some nimble competition into a health insurance market dominated by giants. Sabrina Corlett is a health policy analyst at Georgetown University.
You have in many states one or two big insurers dominating 70, 80, even 90% of the market. So the whole idea behind the co-op plans was to use that competition to bring prices down for consumers.
Bielenson says the co-op would charge about $300 a month for a family of four. Maryland will be setting up an exchange where people can shop for health insurance as part of the health care law. Bielenson expects the co-op to be listed when the exchange opens in 2014. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Well, in Los Angeles this week, auditions took place for the American version of Simon Cowell's talent show X Factor. In Britain, the version there has become a prime way for record companies to scout new acts. Well, the BBC's Rebecca Singer reports the internet has been a factor, good or bad, as well.
Simon Cowell is no longer judging American Idol. He's now working on his new show, The X Factor. It's been on British television for seven seasons, and it's been so successful that it's become one of the British music industry's main ways to discover new pop stars. Mike Smith is managing director of Columbia Records. The walls of his office are covered with music posters, and as he picks through a pile of CDs, he admits to relying on new ways to find hits.
In the old days, you would waste a lot of money travelling around, checking things out that weren't good enough.
But talent scouts aren't just sitting around watching primetime TV. Smith says that isn't going to produce enough records, so labels also search through YouTube and MySpace for the next big thing. And yet, the internet hasn't saved the industry. Roy Eldridge has managed music talent for 40 years. He says music piracy has gobbled up record label profits, usually set aside to develop unknown bands.
It's certainly taking fewer risks now than it has done previously. I think the number of artists being signed is reduced. And I think the labels are being much more conscious of what they're signing.
And with budgets tightened by internet music piracy, the big record labels are instead spending their remaining revenue on promoting older established acts. That's according to a report from consulting firm Deloitte. Alex Mattinson's lead singer for The Single Spy. He has no interest in auditioning for Idol or X Factor.
So for a band like ours, where the music is not uncommercial, but I can't imagine would be top 40, a label's going to be more cautious, perhaps, in terms of putting money into it.
With more than 4 million rock and hip-hop acts on MySpace alone, bands like The Single Spy are struggling more than ever to stand out from the crowd. Instead of being the way home, the internet may have just led bands astray. In London, I'm the BBC's Rebecca Singer for Marketplace.
And finally, Steve, to Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, where Daniel Rains was caught after robbing a bank. Mm-hmm. Now, how do we know his name?
Yeah, how did you get the Daniel Rains?
Because right before he robbed the bank, he gave the teller two forms of identification because he was trying to open up a new account.
He gave the
And then he decided he was going to rob the bank instead of opening up an account.
Is that a crime of passion or something? What was that?
Know.
He just decided to rob the bank?
He just maybe it just came to him as he was
you
telling
think it would
them
click,
about his
though.
Credit
I just
history.
Gave them my name. I just gave him my name and my credit card or whatever ID number and let's rob the bank
no,
today.
No, it didn't make no. it, you know.
Yeah, another
didn't add up for him.
Dumb criminal.
In Los Angeles, I'm Jeremy Hobson and I'm happy to tell you my name because I'm not planning on robbing any banks.
That's good news.
This afternoon.
That's good news.
Yes.
Tomorrow may be another story. Today, though, no bank robberies. I'm Steve Chiotakis. Thanks for being with us for the Marketplace Midday Update.
And this is APM, American Public Media.